Hello and welcome to Euractiv's Agri-Food Podcast. I'm Gerardo Fortuna.
And I'm Natasha Fett.
And here's your weekly update on all things agriculture and food in the EU from Euractiv's Agri-Food team.
So European and African leaders came together this week for a long-delayed EU-Africa summit in Brussels in an attempt to seal the deal on its blueprint for a strategic partnership with Africa 2 years after this was first proposed.
Yeah, there is a lot of push from Europe to relaunch this partnership. And of course, it's mutual because also Africa wants the Europe backing, basically the recovery from the pandemic that also hit Africa as well. There are several topics on the agenda. Of course, the situation with vaccines. Actually, the lack of vaccine in Africa, technology transfer also related to vaccine. Of course, there's also the issue of investments, but there are also agriculture topic. There are, of course, I mean, we're talking about agri-trade, which is one of the main interesting aspects of the entire summit, as well as other aspects that are been neglected, like for instance geographic indication, which is one of the which is one of the best tool in Europe when it comes to agriculture. And the European Commission and the EU collected a lot of experience on this field, and they ready also to share this knowledge about geographic indication with Africa. They recently approved some foodstuff from Africa. They granted EU protection, like the particularly pepper from Cameroon, but also the rooibos tea from South Africa. But again, the main issue is, of course, rural Africa and how to integrate the rural, the strategy for rural areas that was launched last year in Europe. And what could actually be used by, of course, the African rural African farmers and in African rural areas, which is one of the main topic of touched on by Janusz Wojciechowski in his keynote speech ahead of during the summit. I'm literally reading it right now. And he is talking about unlocking the potential of the agri-food sector and rural areas in Africa.
Actually, Gerardo, you had an interesting interview this week with the president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, right?
Indeed. And we discussed about this. We discussed about the fact that rural areas could be an opportunity for growth for Africa. We have, for instance, 12 million youngsters entering the African labor market every year. And at the same time, agriculture is a relevant economic factor in Africa. If you think about it, the primary sector in Europe accounts of about 5% of the GDP. In Africa, we're talking about 20%. So it's quite considerable. Yeah, it's quite considerable. And also, I mean, we also discuss about the role of small-scale farmers when it comes to how they've been hit by COVID and how they can contribute to sorting out some issues of the EU-African partnership, like the migration, for instance. But we also talk about the very important topic for the French presidency of food sovereignty. I mean, it's actually not only about the, it's not only a topic of this government. It's a bit of a French theme. When I was doing the interview, I asked the president if this could be a risk for the agri-trade between Africa and Europe. And he actually replied me with an interesting answer, but let's hear from his voice actually. What do you think about the food sovereignty concept and Europe's push on food sovereignty?
I'm not too much worried about European being total sovereignty in terms of food production and matching the supply and the demand, and which, yes, could reduce a lot of imports from Africa, and that can have an impact on the EU-ACP agreement. But I'm saying that if Africa can do the same with its own domestic, let's say, continental market, under the Continental Free Trade Agreement, there's a huge opportunity for us for growth based from emanating from agriculture.
And we have with us today Brendan Kulzat. Welcome, Brendan.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Brendan is Associate Professor of Environmental Politics at the European School of Political and Social Sciences in Lille. Welcome to our podcast. We could literally talk about everything with you because it's basically your main area of expertise, rural areas, environmental policies. But we'd like you to share with us your experience that you did last year, when you basically spent half of the year on this special road trip, which was also a bit of a farm trip, and in Italy, which is actually my home country. Yes. And so can you tell us a bit more about this experience, Brendan?
So, we could call it a sabbatical in a way. It's legally speaking, it's a parental leave. It's something you can take up when you have a young child at home and you want to take care of it, or you want to take, you know, a few days off the week or something like that. And we decided to spend that in Italy. My family-in-law is from Puglia, from the south. And I think one of the first objectives that we had was to do the olive harvest. For those of you who know a bit of Puglia, I mean, it's full of olive trees, obviously, and the harvest happens in November, and November is kind of the worst time of the year to take holidays, right?
Believe it or not, Brendan. So, Brendan, I'm from Puglia. So believe it or not.
Oh, well, there
he
you
knows
go.
It well.
There you go. And so that was one of the early sort of objectives, and it kind of turned into, well, why not, you know, discover the rest of Italy? Because, you know, we go to Italy every year, but because the family is in Puglia, we always go to Puglia and we don't know the rest of Italy that much. And so it became this big road trip across rural Italy, basically. So going from farm to farm. So we did a whole bunch of different things beyond, of course, the olive harvest.
Yeah, that's nice. So you also took your kids with you. That must have been quite an experience.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I have just one, but I mean, it was quite the right timing because she was getting out of daycare and she was going to start school. And so it was this right moment in her life, I guess, to take her to see Italy, which, you know, also has the family, and so she could pick up a bit of Italian as well. And that was quite an experience indeed.
And so, but you didn't just stay in Puglia, I understand. You kind of moved all around Italy, seeing different projects, different farms, all different things. And I know that you spoke about some of the impacts that you saw on these farms, of the extreme weather conditions that you had there. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about how climate change is already impacting Italian farmers and what strategies you've seen, you know, people are employing to try and help cope with this.
Right. So yeah, we did a whole tour. We started in the north and then worked our way down south, basically following the farming seasons. And as it was getting colder, we were sort of going to the south. We've experienced some of the consequences of climate change very, very drastically, I'd say. I mean, it was a particularly dry summer. This year, the vineyards we worked with in Tuscany, they didn't see rain for like 4 months. We were there in September. They hadn't seen rain in 4 months. And so the consequence of that was that they had lost about half of their yields. It wasn't just drought. It was a late frost. It was a delayed flowering. It was extreme temperatures. Italy broke a record this year with almost 49 degrees Celsius in Sicily. So that affects like yield and quality of crops that are not irrigated, obviously, but also the sort of highly resilient ones like olive trees are also sort of impacted by that, and so farmers are trying to adapt to that in finding new varieties, new techniques. But there's only so much they can do, of course, because you know the season is getting shorter and shorter, and so they have to collect or harvest at some time. And so this leads to all sorts of problems with yields and quality.
And also, I would like to jump on one thing that you highlighted in your long thread on Twitter. You basically shared your experience with your followers. In particular, it's something that is dear to me because, again, I'm from Puglia and I'm from this town that you visited, Foggia. Where there's this phenomenon of exploitative conditions of mostly migrant workers on farms to pick tomatoes and other foodstuff products. So, what's your take on this phenomenon? What do you see on the ground when it comes to the exploitation of workers?
I mean, there's different elements to it, and first we should say that it's not something that is only in Italy. You know, the whole European agriculture relies for part on migrant labor. I mean, there's places in other countries. Think of Almeria in Spain, for example, that has the same kind of problems. So it's not just Italy. It's just that we were in Italy, so I talked about Italy. But yeah, I mean, one of the direct consequences of places like Foggia is that basically they're going to flood the market with cheap produce, cheap fruits, cheap vegetables, rock bottom prices in supermarket. When you go to these, you know, discount supermarkets and you have tomatoes for €1 a kilo, I mean that's where they come from, right? And so this sort of, in a way, destroys local economies that people are trying to set up around organic agriculture, for example, because it's impossible to compete with that kind of, you know, sort of extreme corporate concentration, organized crime, modern day slavery. They basically pay migrant laborers very little and make lots of profit. So it's really hard for the communities we lived with to kind of compete with that and make a living out of a form of agriculture that is more respectful of the environment, more respectful of people, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. And you mentioned there about local economies. And so were you mainly kind of dealing with small organic farms? Because one of my questions was actually going to be about, you know, the economic viability of some of these farms and whether a lot of the farms that you visited were managing to, you know, to make a living, to economically survive.
Yeah, I mean, we used the woofing network. Some of the listeners may know, and it's a very specific type of farm. It's only organic farms. It's rather smaller farms. It's not the sort of big industrial farming activity. So that sort of tweaks it changes the image a bit, right? I'd say that you had different types. You had people that were doing this full-time, main activity, and working out quite well, sometimes going to great length in having their produce on the market and having to drive 2 hours to go to the nearest city, for example, to be able to sell their produce because locally they couldn't do it. But I haven't seen sort of extreme economic hardship in these farms. And then you had other people that were doing this more as a bit of a side gig, right? They're doing a lot of other things. And this is also part of this recent movement where you had a lot of, not only in Italy, but of everywhere, we had a lot of people from the cities moving back to the countryside, basically, and combining a bit of their old activities with a farming activities of different kinds.
So you're seeing kind of lots of people moving out into the countryside. And did you see also, I mean, I know generational renewal is a massive issue, well, all across Europe, but also in Italy. Did you see a lot of young people wanting to get involved or getting involved in these kind of farming projects?
Yes. I mean, it's not an age thing. I've come across farmers that were, close to retirement age, and I've come across farmers that were, just starting. So they're there. This story about youth leaving the countryside isn't sort of always the case everywhere. I mean, there's places in Italy where it's really bad, but there's other places where, because of the location, obviously, when you're in Tuscany and you're half an hour away from Firenze, it's not the same kind of place, and it's not sort of abandoned by young people. You come across these a lot, actually.
So thanks, Brandon, for your insights and for having shared your experience with our listeners.
Hello and welcome to our Flavor of the Week. This week we have a doubly special edition because we have a flavor that's linked to two things that happened this week. Which are Valentine's Day and the EU-African Union Summit. Very linked, because they both have to do with cocoa.
It was very tough to find something.
We managed to tie them up.
Yeah.
It's quite impressive, I have to say. I mean, if I say so for ourselves, it's impressive. We're impressive.
Timely, I would say, timely.
So you can imagine a Venn diagram of like Valentine's Day, Africa, and in the middle, we have cacao.
That's beautiful.
Or cocoa.
Cacao and cocoa.
Let's say chocolate.
Okay. All right. So why are we talking about chocolate? Right. Take it away, Julia.
Whether you celebrated Valentine's Day or Galentine's Day or both, the chances are that chocolate was involved in your celebrations. Because according to polls, chocolate or pralines are the second most popular Valentine's Day gift after perfume and cosmetics. Personally, I don't really understand why chocolate doesn't top the list, but research has...
Incomprehensible.
Cosmetics.
Guys, I also don't understand what is Galentine's Day.
Valentine's Day, where you show love for your gals.
Really?
It's important.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Oh my. We were all sending messages like happy Galentine's to all my girlfriends. Not all my girlfriends.
Okay. Now I understand why I haven't ever heard about this. Okay.
You're not a gal, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Yeah.
The more you know.
Oh, but... please. Sorry, Julia. Go ahead.
But new research has also found that the chocolate industry also benefits from a rising self-care trend around Valentine's Day. So basically treating yourself, which is also a good idea. But also all year round, the EU consumes a lot of chocolate. EU countries are big fans and consume an above average amount. And it may come as a surprise that the top chocolate fans in the world are not actually Belgians, as you might expect, but Germans, with the largest per capita consumption, which is 11 kilograms a year. Well, the average is less than 1 kilogram a year.
So you collected this data, Julia?
I did from personal experience.
Ah, okay. As a German. Because, I mean, that we actually live in, me and Tasha are living in Belgium, so we can't be targeted for such an allegation. So I just want to tell our listener that I don't agree with this.
I can personally assure you that I eat 11 kilograms of chocolate per year.
At least.
It's definitely also a cash crop because the European chocolate market was valued at 46 billion euros in 2020. And it's not just recently that people have been going crazy about chocolate or cocoa or cacao, because consumption of cacao was first rooted in Mesoamerican history, and it was a highly prized luxury item among Mayan and Incan upper classes. Cocoa beans were actually once so valuable that they were sometimes used to pay taxes. And by the early 17th century, the trend had also reached Europe, and it became fashionable, for example, at the Palace of Versailles under Louis XIV, the Sun King. And fun fact about that, when Marie Antoinette married him in 1770, she actually brought her own chocolate maker to court.
Wow, she had her priorities in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, this thing of paying taxes with cocoa beans is really interesting. I think we should relaunch this this idea. But I have some...
Belgium might be open to that.
Belgium, yeah. It could become a tax haven. Okay. guys, I have two curiosities about chocolate and EU. So I do the boring one. So you know that there's actually a directive, actually two directives related to cocoa and chocolate products. They both dated back to 2000, and it's basically allows the use of vegetable fats other than cocoa butter for the manufacturing of products, of chocolate products, which is quite interesting because there was a case brought at the European Court of Justice between the Commission and Italy. Because I've grown up in Italy, so when I was a kid, Every commercial related to chocolate had the the claim pure chocolate, no, puro cioccolato from, and actually this pure chocolate thing wasn't in compliance with the directive for the mere fact that this adjective pure to the sales name. So basically, Italy used this adjective pure to chocolate that didn't contain vegetable fats other than cocoa butter. But the commission saying that this would create, a double standard. And in the end, the court backed the commission stance, saying that the chocolate products with vegetables, fats other than cocoa butter could, of course, shouldn't be distinguished by the other, with this name, pure chocolate. This is a curiosity. And the second curiosity was about a question that an MEP, a socialist MEP, is still MEP now, who asked the commission in 2013 if to push for a ban on confectionery and toys designed for children that look like tobacco-based products. So basically it was referring to the chocolate cigarettes.
I remember those.
Yeah. And indeed, they don't exist anymore. I mean, I don't see them anymore.
Oh, that's true. We also had gum cigarettes, if you remember those.
Or gum cigarettes. Okay. And there's actually a cancer recommendation, so it's basically a guideline from the commission, from approved by member states in 2003 on the prevention of smoking, which basically call on member states to prohibit the sale of sweets and toys intended for children and manufactured with the clear intention that the product would resemble in appearance a type of tobacco product. So that's why, I mean, and it's up to member states to approve or put in their national legislation this kind of recommendation, because again, it's a recommendation. But it's that's why, for instance, in certain countries, chocolate cigarette disappeared. These were my curiosities.
Fun facts.
Super fun facts. Interesting.
And let's talk about now. So obviously this chocolate has to come from somewhere. And although Europe is dominating chocolate manufacturing, of course, it's not producing it. We have to get it from somewhere else. And actually, a large part of that comes from Africa, so especially West Africa. So the Ivory Coast makes up 40% of the market share of the cacao bean supplies to Europe. That's followed in second place by Ghana and Nigeria. But there's been a lot of concerns about working conditions on cacao plantations to do with fair pay for workers in these countries, and a lot of cases of child labour. I remember there were some famous cases of this, I think to do with Nestlé a few years ago, so in which, you know, large chocolate retailers have been accused of these cases in their supply chains. And so a lot of concerns around this, and this led to the creation, there was the Fair Trade label, which I'm sure lots of people are really familiar with, which certifies that farmers and workers producing these beans have received an additional premium on top of their wage. But there's still a lot of criticism about this. So there's a lot of campaigners warning it's getting a bit confusing because there are lots of different kind of labels, making it hard for consumers to judge, you know, what's really behind that label and what really the conditions were behind creating these cacao beans that produced their beloved chocolate in Europe. And they were also saying that on the ground, it's getting increasingly difficult for small farmers with less resources to kind of gain the contacts and the resources to fulfill the necessary conditions to secure this fair trade label. And in the news from the capitals this week, first up, we have Ireland. So this week, Ireland's Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, along with the Irish Food Board, plus a bunch of representatives from Ireland's agri-food companies, took off on a week-long trade mission to the United Arab Emirates and also to Saudi Arabia. And the trip actually proved to be quite fruitful. It ended with the expansion of the market access for Irish beef in Saudi Arabia. So up until now, there has been a restriction, meaning that Irish beef exported to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia had to come from cattle slaughtered under 30 months of age. But this agreement has been reached this week to lift this. And the minister also added that there has been some more commitments from the Saudi Food and Drug Authority for more technical engagement on sheep meat access, and also the possibility in the future of extending this to poultry as well. So watch this space.
And we move to Strasbourg, but to talk about Spain and Portugal, so the Iberian Peninsula, because during the plenary this week, there was a debate between the MEPs and the Equality Commissioner Elena Dalli about the serious drought situation suffered in Spain and in Portugal. And Dalli, the Commissioner Dalli, also said that it might be possible for affected farmers to get support from the Rural Development Fund, which is the second pillar of the Common Agricultural Policy, as well as the European Agricultural Guarantee Fund. And as Natasha said, watch this space, because Spain and Portugal agriculture minister will put this in the agenda of the next Agri-Fish Council on Monday in Brussels. So it's definitely something that will be addressed also by other ministers.
And finally, we move to Germany, where we see increasing calls to end marketing of unhealthy products to children. While Germany's government coalition is actually working on plans to ban ads for unhealthy products that are aimed at children, this week stakeholders have come together to call for a very stringent and strict regulation on this. So for example, they called to introduce a ban on poster ads for unhealthy products around schools, and also to ban TV ads for these between 6 a.m. and 11 p.m. during the day. And these organizations said that this will be necessary for the protection of children and teenagers, which they said in a joint position paper that they released this week, together with health insurance companies, the German Alliance for Non-Communicable Diseases, and also the Consumer Protection Authority. And these organizations also stressed that, especially since the beginning of the pandemic, the number of children with obesity has actually been growing, which makes this problem all the more pressing. But on the other hand, the advance was criticized by the advertising industry, and they argued that it was misleading to argue that obesity in children was only caused by marketing and that you shouldn't target marketing in ads for this. And this is all in the context that the German coalition, in their coalition agreement, have vowed to rein in ads for unhealthy food, so food that is high in salt, fat, sugar, that are geared towards children under 14. That's all from us this week. This week, the AgriFood podcast is produced by Euractiv's AgriFood team, Gerardo Fortuna, Natasha Foot, and Julia Dahm, with the technical support of Abby Chiori. This podcast is also available on all major streaming platforms, including Apple, Amazon, Stacker, and Spotify.
Be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss the latest news from the EU. I'm Natasha Foot. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next week.